A spirit, well known when in Earth life, said one evening to a gentleman who worked with me, and who helped obtain the information now given the public. The intense satisfaction that is the constant result of right doing, based on honest purpose, is, in itself, sufficient reward for action. Of all the trite sayings of the Bible, the one that reads, "What shall it profit a man, if he shall gain the whole world, and yet lose his own soul?" is one with the greatest meaning. Wealth brings many opportunities for good and for evil, in fact, there are more for the latter than for the former, as the besetting sin of mortal man is selfishness and the possession of great riches allows free expression of that greatest of all sources of trouble. The true and full meaning of the word selfishness is in every way opposite to the most beautiful word in your language, charity. Shorn of their meaning, as applied to money, they are the negative and positive of man's character. The fullest opportunity of giving expression to these two opposite words comes with the possession of great wealth. The understanding of the full meaning of these two words is the truest index of a man's character. The ability to make one's life the embodiment of that wonderful word charity, and to understand that other word selfishness so as to avoid it, is the true test of mortal man's ability to control himself. Self-control is man's perfect condition. To know charity and practice its meaning, to know selfishness and keep it from you, this is self-control. This state of existence is as near perfection as the earthly mortal can hope to get. You have been chosen one among many on your side of life to bring certain great truths to the people of the world. In advance of time, you are to be prepared for the time of your usefulness, and this is one of the moments of laying before you certain truths. To teach the truth, the teacher must be truthful. To induce others to accept pure and honest principles, the teacher must be pure and honest himself. To set certain facts before others, the teacher must be above criticism. You may honestly atone for those things that have so far occurred in your life, by making amends to those to whom you are indebted. So far as the errors of your past life are concerned, you have well and strongly conquered their chief cause, and you need no longer fear them. You have henceforth no excuse to do otherwise than follow the honorable and ennobling instincts of your nature. Guard well your actions, that they may not be open to criticism from others, and particularly from the one of all others from whom you cannot escape, your own self. You have been, and you are being, weighed in the balance, and so much is expected of you, that you must not be found wanting. Remember that wealth brings the opportunity to give expression to what is best in your nature, and that you will find the only reward for doing good in that intense feeling of satisfaction that can come only as the result of a good deed, unselfishly done. It is well that man should earn his daily bread. It is the intention of nature that every mortal should struggle, for by no other means can he progress in the scale of being. This being so, one so situated that he can live without a proper exertion on his part, is unfortunate. Never forget this principle: the waste of money is not charity, but foolishness. You will find many practical ways to do good and to do it in the right way. A clean tenant demands a clean habitation. A pure heart and a pure mind are the results of your own efforts so to keep them. Charity is not a formula, it is thought, clothed with a kind act. Cultivate charity in judging others, try to draw out the latent good in them, rather than to discover the hidden evil. We must do this if we would rise to the full glory of our privilege, to the dignity of true living, to the supreme charity of the world. Chapter 18 Fragments. Notwithstanding the many years of this research, we were always careful to utilize our strength to the best possible advantage. Little time was spent with tests and personalities, none with frivolities. It was a dignified, scientific work, wherein we sought knowledge to the utmost. At times there would come concrete and definite statements with great rapidity and of tremendous import. It seemed as if the group of spirit people wanted to say as much as possible in the fewest words. Frequently I asked slower speech, so that my stenographer might get the statements correctly, and I recall being told that it was impossible at times to slow the message. When conditions were right, they had to send them through or lose the opportunity. I have gathered from my records short, terse statements from various communications received from those in the afterlife, some beyond worldly teaching, that seem worthy of publication. The following are but a few of thousands, mere fragments of spirit philosophy. Force wherever found or how expressed, is life. Each change in spirit existence is partly hidden from the plane below, because the conditions of each change make it best for the soul to fit itself for progression without absolute knowledge of the next step. When the intellect ceases to be enslaved, the body becomes free. The supreme need of each man is to reason and to remain, ever after, true to his convictions. Where reason leads, each should follow publicly and openly. This is the highest conception of duty. Man's conscience is his judgment seat, and reparation for wrong cannot begin too soon. Love for humanity is the basis upon which mankind must stand to gain ultimate good. Brood well upon that with which you store your mind. Each grain of knowledge will grow and bear its fruit. Dissolution is simply the throwing aside of the physical garment, the outer covering composed of flesh compounds, whereupon the individual becomes an inhabitant of another sphere of usefulness, differing only in its intensity. Inhabitants of this material world cannot see the spirit form while in the body, neither can they see it when separated from the body. All life has intelligence, all intelligence has language, all language, expression. One who does right and has the courage of his convictions, will find in the afterlife a radiant happiness, and the censure of this little world will fail to sting. A thought born in your mind is for good or evil, a thing to be reckoned with again in the afterlife, when it will confront you face to face, and claim you as its author. Do you not think that the great intelligence that planned millions of worlds, and made them move with perfect harmony and precision, that peopled them, that fixed and marked each one's course, and lighted its pathway in infinite space, knows what is best? At dissolution, each sense is quickened, and all that fills space is visible to the spiritual senses and tangible to spiritual touch and brain. Space must then take form, substance and reality, a world of thought, boundless and endless. The rains will come when they are timed. They will replenish the green of the harvest and make it richer. The storms of life may beat upon you, but you will find they only break down the dead branches, and you will be more straight and fair for their passing. All about this material world there exists actually the psychic or spiritual universe, more active and real than this, peopled with all the countless dead, who, no longer burdened with a physical body, move at will within the boundaries of their sphere, in what appears as space to mortal man. In the kingdom of the mind there can be no personal dictation, there is no God but universal good, no savior but oneself, no trinity but matter, force and mind. Life beyond the grave is the promise that hope has ever whispered to all who have lived. The sovereignty of the individual must be gained by effort. The weak must be taught, the strongest at some time must bend and obey. To every mortal who thinks rightly, nature's laws become natural laws. Dissolution is a step in evolution, and involves no mental change, adding nothing, subtracting nothing, but simply increasing the opportunities for observation and learning. Men who deny to others the right of public speech are not qualified for speech themselves. If you would impress your thought on others, and spread the truth, make that thought the highest expression of truth. Make yourself attuned to the most harmonious vibrations, so that your impulses will be good, and then obey them. They are apartment to be the suggestions of a fellow soul working out his salvation. Mind is the aggregate of all thoughts, mind is the universal thought. As a drop of water signifies but one infinitesimal part of the great ocean, so a thought is but one infinitesimal part of the great ocean of mind. Deeds are thoughts grown to maturity, and yet a thought unspoken or unlived, will exist through all the ages, as though expressed. Everything is governed by law, nothing happens by chance, cause and effect are as potent in the spirit plane as in the earth plane. There are sounds that our ears have never heard, there is light that our physical eyes can never see, there is an invisible world filled with people that few have ever imagined. Life would be but a futile thing, and all effort useless, if the future did not stretch before us, endless and unlimited in its possibilities. The justice that meets the naked soul, on the threshold of its spirit life, is terrible in its completeness. The tendency of all life, wheresoever found or howsoever clothed, is to perfect, improve, increase and extend its sphere of usefulness. This is evolution. It is a fact, a law and not a theory, and its possibilities are as boundless as the imagination. The atom, alone, has eternal duration of form, for it alone has the power to enter and dominate all other forms. It has no master except force, and to force alone is it amenable. The wealth that all in this physical world should seek, has not the ring of gold, it is gathered by right living and by helping others to live right. It is far better to have committed an honest error and reap no profit, than to have great profit and to have honesty gone from your own heart. Selfishness in the human heart is the cause of all evil. Where selfishness dwells, love cannot abide. Selfishness and love cannot occupy the same place at the same time. An atom from the great ocean of spirit finds lodgment in a physical organism and behold, a man. Mortal needs spirit suggestion, but spirits indeed of mortal thought have just as great a need. Life enough is given to rule each day in our kingdom, but not enough for tomorrow. Wisdom is born in the soul of man when he recognizes that natural law governs and accounts for all things. If a man is clean, he feels clean, and keeping clean inspires him to clean deeds. Wisdom, power, beneficence, and the peace that passeth all understanding, these come not from above, but from within. If a man can make himself habitually right in his thought and desire, right in his will and purpose, he must become right in the tissues built up out of the mind's action. Power is born of desire. No man can earnestly desire to live upon a high plane and yet be compelled to live upon a low plane, since we live in that state of development that we create for ourselves. Every life is placed exactly where it should be, and is in touch with the environment needed at that hour to unfold itself. It is thought that builds the body. Thought is food, thought is force, the motor power, by means of which the soul expresses itself in physical form. Chapter 19 Intellectual Progress. At the funeral of John G. Mills on April 15, 1883, Robert G. Ingersoll, the great agnostic, said, "Again we stand face to face with the great mystery that shrouds the world. We question, but there is no reply. Out on the wide waste seas, there drifts no spar. Over the desert of death the Sphinx gazes forever, but does not speak. All wish for happiness beyond this life, all hope to meet again the loved and lost. Immortality is a word that hope through all the ages has been whispering to love. The mystery of life and death, we cannot understand. The golden bridge of life from gloom emerges, and on shadow rests. Beyond this we do not know. Fate is speechless, destiny is dumb, and the secret of the future has never yet been told. We love, we wait, we hope. What can we say of death? What can we say of the dead? Where they have gone, reason cannot go, and from thence revelation has not come." This is a fair statement by a fair man of the general understanding of that subject at that time. Since those words were uttered, more progress has been made than in the 1,000 years prior to that time. The telephone has come into practical use, the automobile has displaced the horse, electricity lights the world and propels our engines and cars. The human voice is heard across the continent and over the ocean. We navigate the air, and ships call to each other over the waters for help when in distress. Progress has not been confined to things physical. Within that time we have also come to know what the change called death is, and are able to comprehend the process involved and to explain it scientifically. Its mystery, like all other mysteries, disappears when the simple natural law is understood. Earnest men have called and questioned, the dead have answered, and life and death is, in a measure, understood. We find there is no golden bridge, no dark stream, to cross. All life is one on different planes. Where the so-called dead have gone, reason has now followed, and the revelation has come from those who live and labor beyond our vision and touch. We now know what physical change takes place at the time of dissolution, and, when conditions are properly met, we now may talk with those who seem to have left us, voice to voice. This is not the discovery of any one man. For the last decade and more, great thinkers have devoted their thought and energy to discover what before was a mystery, and have had the courage to give the world the result of their scientific investigations. More has been written on this subject in the last 20 years than on perhaps any other, but only a small percentage of those classed as thinkers know it. Only those who think for themselves read this class of literature. The great majority never give this subject a thought and do not want to know, though it is of more vital importance than any other matter. Some there are who face the east and sincerely welcome the light, others stand with their backs to the sunrise and worship the sunset of the day before. Among well-known scholars who stand for this great truth may be mentioned Wallace, Crookes, Rear Admiral Moore, Stead, Lodge and Doyle, of England, Richet, of France, Lombroso, of Italy, Stanford, of Australia, Wu Tingtang, of China, Carrington, Funk and Professor Hislop, of America. All these have written on their individual discoveries, based on evidential facts. This field has been fully covered. The continuity of life has been proved and as well established as any other fact in nature. But these facts and incidents are so out of the ordinary that the human mind has difficulty in grasping them. It is difficult to comprehend what one has not actually experienced. I do not intend to make this presentation technically evidential, except as the incidents related and the source of my knowledge carry conviction. I want to come to the public through the valley of reason, so to present my facts that they appeal to all, for when they are found reasonable and in accordance with nature's law and purpose, they will be accepted. They must be accepted, for the facts have been gathered from those who are now in the afterlife, and who can better describe what death, so-called, is than those who have passed through it. Who can better explain the conditions under which they live, and the place, than men of earth who now live there? I was able to do this work, because of the assistance of Emily S. French, then the world's finest voice psychic, who gave the latter years of her life to this work and to me, without money and without price. She was so deaf that she seldom heard the spirit voices, and during the latter years frail and blind, but in her presence the dead spoke, and all within sound of spirit voices could hear as well as I could, and hundreds at my invitation did so. Interest in this subject has grown tremendously of late years. There are circles of investigators in almost every town and city, as well as in many private homes. In this manner the work is carried forward. It has been my privilege to talk with Ingersoll, from whose speech I have quoted, on many occasions. I have heard his spirit voice ring with the volume of his earlier years. His eloquence no man ever equaled. He established identity and told of his work in the afterlife, as well as of his mission in this, which was to arouse and make people think. He is doing the same work now, only with greater understanding, and, because of this privilege and because of his answer to the doubts he expressed, I quote from his speech. He has answered all the questions he asked when here, and in these chapters, though I seldom use names, are various statements made by him as to conditions which he finds in that life. With all my research and opportunity, I have come to know just a little of the conditions in and along the frontier. Ages will be required to come into full knowledge. Nature puts before our eyes more than we can see, in our ears more than we can hear, and to the mind more than it can comprehend. We gather what we sow, gain what we work for, and have no right to expect something for nothing. We cannot get knowledge without study, understanding without thinking, but right thinking slowly and surely brings knowledge. What I hope to do is to set in motion a line of reasoning, based on the facts that I have stated, which will appeal to all who read this work, and through such process and original research, lead to understanding. Then shall we do those things that will enrich beyond the grave, and enable one to enter the new life with dignity and credit. In view of the progress in knowledge that has been made in this field, it is not unreasonable for me to hope to do this. The thinking mind should not require proof of survival. We know nothing can be destroyed, as nothing in nature ever has been. The idea that man can be annihilated when a clod of earth cannot be, is preposterous. The thinker should start with the proposition that man survives, and then bend his efforts to know in what invisible plane he functions. It is really not a question of whether life continues, but where and how. Darwin, foremost among naturalists, Wagner, the greatest of composers, Hugo, poet and patriot, Huxley and Faraday, among the scientists, Chopin, Mendelssohn, Mozart, Beethoven, Paganini, Verdi and Liszt, among the musicians, Gladstone, Lincoln and Roosevelt, the world's great statesmen, are not dead. These mighty rivers of intellectual thought and beauty have not ceased to flow, for in death they reach the sea. In other fields of opportunity these great minds labor on such individualities can never die, this earth life but prepared them for a greater work. How absurd, too, for one to think that the master intelligence, working through nature would produce such great souls and then, just in the fullness of their mentality, destroy them. It seems almost presumption for me to undertake to prove continuity, so certain to the thinking mind. The only justification I can find is in the fact that this whole subject has been given little consideration by the many and is, therefore, little known. In making this presentation, I recognize no distinction among men. It is equally important that the non-thinker should understand what earth life leads to, as it is for the intellectual. In the democracy of death, only spirituality counts. When we look up into the sky, and see nothing between us and the stars, we are really looking through a realm as rich in detail as the landscape we can see on a fine day from a mountain top. This region is inhabited by myriads of a human family, among them many we have loved and lost and will rejoin in due time. And this is not guesswork nor metaphysical speculation but the definite result of observation, as scientific in character as that concerned with astronomy or spectroscopic analysis. Chapter 20 Looking into the Future. The book is made. At a dinner given by the Buffalo Bar Association, these words fell from the lips of its guest of honor, one of the most distinguished lawyers in America. It was a notable gathering. He had returned from a larger field of endeavor, rich in worldly goods. His career had been remarkable. In the fullness of his success, with a record of 70 years behind him, he had come back for a day to meet those whom he knew in other times. This man, generous to a fault, friendly in manner, ever ready to serve the public good, candid and masterful in speech, a great citizen, intellectually honest, thoroughly informed in worldly affairs, but without a particle of knowledge beyond this world of men, having all the glory that could come from professional life, seeing nothing beyond, sadly said, to that eager group that came to do him honor, "The book is made." This great mind, engrossed in the affairs of the present, like the great majority of mankind, had not had time to inquire, much less to learn, what this life leads to. Knowing nothing of the future, he felt his life work was finished. It was December, the sun was so low that the shadows fell in front, and his thoughts went back in memory to dreams of youth. Had he known that all his years of labor but prepared him for a life of more intense reality, following upon the heels of this, he would have said, "The foreword has been written, and in the great beyond I will write the book in acts and kindly deeds." We, who have come in touch with life in the great beyond, look with a sorrow that words cannot express upon those who neither know nor care, and those who fear what they call death we would lead from darkness into light and knowledge. Why should we fear that which has or will come to all, in accordance with nature's law? We cannot tell which is the greater blessing, birth or dissolution, both are good. It has been a great privilege to have had birth and growth and love, with all the joy that has been ours. All has been in accordance with nature, and nature is God. But the end comes not with that natural change so long called death, which we know to be according to nature. Even if we did not actually know what followed, any thinking mind should appreciate that all changes in nature are for our good. Over every cradle nature bends and smiles, and tenderly to those whom we think dead she beckons and welcomes. For into this zone we passed bodily, our inner body the same as now, holding all the failures and triumphs met within this journey. Those conditions no honest man should fear. The idea of immortality, like the sea, ebbed and flowed in the human heart, beating with endless waves, since time began. All hope that they may reach the shore, but the words hope and faith concede that the fact is unknown. Uncertainty and ignorance breed fear. If one must rest his salvation on belief alone, let it be the gospel of help. A kind act is better than a theory. This life is designed to fit us for a greater work. I do not criticize nature, or the master intelligence that planned our progression. I have not arrived at the state of mind where I feel competent to criticize any natural law. All others are conceded for our good. Why not the last? And if that be true, why weep and shed bitter tears, when in this change we advance to another and higher existence? The microscope discovered a new world, the telescope millions more. Everywhere has been found infinite life. In all explorations there has been found nothing independent of, or superior to, nature, and in that presence I find God. Common notions about death are all wrong. Nothing ever dies. None who have gone ever want to come back. Must not that life be most engaging and fair? When a good man goes, his soul is filled with light, for his good deeds shine like stars. A noble life enriches itself and all the world. But all lives are not lived worthily. Think of the vast multitude, the endless procession, that hourly pass, leaving no thought, no truth, as a legacy of mankind. From the frontiers of the afterlife, from that belt or zone where spirit people live, they send us cheering messages. They speak in full-toned voice and write, as when they lived among us. And so we come to know the dead have never died. And then again we are told, that in the next plane, the continuation of this, the basest soul will find its way and have the everlasting chance of doing right, and that the better souls, the finer men and women, pass at once to opportunity and happiness. In these chapters I have stated facts and narrated incidents as I have come to know them from those actually living in the afterlife. With all the strength that I possess, with all the personality that lies behind a life of effort, I vouch for the truth of what I have written. I sought in the beginning to bring to the understanding propositions of vital importance, though practically new to every thinking mind. I restate them as follows. 1. Here and now, within our physical and visible bodies, is an invisible, living, active, inner body, composed and made up of substance or material which we term ether. It is this body that is permanent, holding form, feature and expression, while the outer flesh covering, with which it is clothed, changes from hour to hour. Death or dissolution is but the final separation of the inner body, which is invisible before as well as after, from the physical body. The spirit body passes into the next etheric plane of existence, vibrating in harmony with all that is there, where all is just as tangible and material to them as this plane is to us who are still in the physical. This change is nature's process for advancing our plane of activity, and is not to be feared any more than birth. 2. The next fact that I would bring to human consciousness is the location of this afterlife, where spirit people live. No subject is so little known and so vital to our understanding. Let me restate this condition as follows. Around and about the earth are belts or zones of exceeding fine matter, a substance called ether, varying in character or density. Very similar to those belts or zones that the telescope has discovered about the planets Jupiter and Saturn. They are all just as much substance as the earth itself. The outer belts or zones being higher in vibration and lighter than those that touch and really blend with the earth itself. In those zones, from the substance that composes them, all structures and things are built and formed naturally, as here. They have fields and meadow land, rugged mountains and deep forests, homes, buildings, books, paintings, music, sculpture and institutions of learning. What we have are imperfect imitations of what exists, and first existed, there. Too long we have held the thought that the universe was specially created for us. The infinite mind which formed and fashioned this planet, who fixed its pathways and made the definite law through which mankind should obtain his development, had the wisdom, power and intelligence to create and provide conditions and a place in nature for man to finish what was here begun. because we have not heretofore discovered and located the boundaries of the next life, should not lead us to the conclusion that such place or condition has not existed from the beginning. Men did not know of the continent of America until 1492, but it had been here millions of years before. We have not had actual knowledge of the afterlife until of late, but it too has existed for all time.